So our first presenter is Dr. Paul Glassman, and for those of you who don't know, he's actually my boss. So, so Dr. Glassman is a professor of dental practice and director of community oral health at the University of Pacific Arthur A. Degoni School of Dentistry in San Francisco. He is the director of the Pacific Center for Special Care and director of the California Statewide Task Force on Oral Health for People with Disabilities and Aging Californians. He has served on many national panels, including the Institute of Medicine's Committee on Oral Health Access to Services, which produced the IOM report on improving access to oral health care for vulnerable and underserved populations, and the board of directors of the DentaQuest Institute. Finally, Dr. Glassman has been prominent in advocacy efforts on the state and national level for health system reform to improve oral health systems for a wide variety of underserved groups. Our second presenter is Dr. Irene Hilton. She is a staff dentist at the San Francisco Department of Public Health and the dental consultant for the National Network for Oral Health Access. For 10 years, Dr. Hilton was moderator of the Quality Assurance Committee for the San Francisco Department of Public Health Dental Bureau. She is a member of the ASTDD Best Practices Committee and contributed to the recent publication, Oral Health Quality Improvement in the Era of Accountability. So we're going to first start with Dr. Glassman.
Okay, thanks, Mesa. Well, it's nice to have a room full of friends. Some of you have actually heard a version of this talk before, so maybe it's one of those things where you pick up another little tidbit the second or third or fourth time through. But my charge today is to talk about the sort of big picture of where the country is going in terms of oral health quality improvement and accountability. And I'm going to try and paint the picture that this is going to be a very important influence on where oral health goes in the next decade. So first, a few quick disclosures. I do run a research center at the University of Pacific, and we do have funding for policy development. And I'm going to just mention a few things that have, with outside funding. I was a member of the Institute of Medicine Committee on Oral Health Access to Care, and I'm going to mention just a little bit about that. I was co-director of the National Quality Forum Expert Panel on Oral Health Quality Measures, and I'm going to talk a little bit about that work as well, and also dental representative of the AHRQ CHIPRA Expert Panel on Pediatric Quality Measurement, a member of the DentaQuest Board of Directors, and chair of the DentaQuest National Quality Improvement Committee, and in spite of all that, no financial conflicts of interest. So, shows I do a lot of volunteer work. So the thesis here is that we are entering an era of profound change in our healthcare system. As I do this presentation, I want to ask you to think about this Zen saying, which is keeping your head in the clouds and the feet on the ground at the same time. And I interpret this Zen saying as meaning that if you're on the path to enlightenment and you're trying to spend your mental energy contemplating the nature of reality and your place in the universe, that at the same time you still have to live in the world, and you got to get up every day, and you got to get dressed, and you got to feed yourself and get through the day. And so I think the Zen approach to all that is to try and do both at the same time. As you're going through your daily routines, try and keep in mind the big picture of what life is all about and your relationship to the universe. So I think we have the same challenge here. I'm going to be talking about some things that I think are going to have profound effects on the oral healthcare delivery system over the next decade or even longer. But at the same time, we still live in a world which doesn't really reflect some of the things I'm going to be saying. And so I think our challenge is to keep in mind this big picture of where things are going. At the same time, we're going about our daily lives and trying to keep in those two things in perspective at the same time, which certainly is challenging. So first, just a quick mention of the IOM reports on oral health. I'm going to talk a little bit more about these in a session this afternoon. So I only have this one slide at the moment, which is a couple of themes from the two IOM reports from last year, looking at access and delivery systems. So the IOM is recommending a movement towards chronic disease management, recognizing that our two major dental diseases are, in fact, chronic diseases, and our traditional surgical acute care approach to chronic diseases is not the right approach for the future. We need to be thinking about chronic care management approaches to those diseases. That in terms of our evolving delivery systems, we're in the 21st century, there are telehealth tools that enable people to communicate across distances, and we need to be thinking more about using those. That there are mechanisms now evolving in terms of payment incentives and workforce expansion that can be brought to bear on our delivery system. And finally, all these things can be driven through the change in all in these directions can be driven through the tools of quality measurement and improvement, which is what I'm going to mostly focus on this morning. So many of you have seen this report, which I was involved in producing for the Kellogg Foundation on Oral Health Quality Improvement in the Era of Accountability. And if you haven't and you want to get a copy of it, it's downloadable from the Kellogg website. I want to just mention now a few minutes on what I think are the major drivers of health reform in our country and try and make the point that these things all apply to our all health care delivery system. So the major drivers of health reform are the skyrocketing costs of our health care delivery system, increasing understanding of harm and variability of results, the profound health disparities that result, and increasing awareness of these problems. So let's start with the cost of health care. Again, many of you have seen this data, but if you look at either the left side, which is the average spending in the U.S. Per capita, or the right side, which is the average spending per as a percentage of GDP, the red line is the United States. The other lines are the other developed countries in the world. And you can easily see that the United States, where it was in the pack back in the 1980s, has pulled way out of the pack as time has gone by. And this is not a race that you want to win, because we are increasingly spending a much larger share of our GDP on healthcare than the rest of the developed world, and there's no way to remain competitive in a developing global economy with that kind of spending on healthcare. So this is something from the Health Policy Institute, which looks at the contribution, or predicts the contribution to the deficit between now and 2052, and you can see the little title at the top says, "Wake up, folks, it's healthcare," and shows that while the contribution to the deficit from other things that receive lots more attention, and certainly in terms of our political debates for this election, you hear people talking about Social Security and other mandatory programs. I'm surprised how little discussion there has been in this election about healthcare, but clearly the major contribution to the deficit going forward would be healthcare spending if it continues on its current trajectory. And not only do we spend a lot more money than the other developed countries, we get a lot poorer results. There are many, many indicators of our results, and this is just one of them, which is this is the average 15-year survival for 45-year-old women, and shows that in 1975 the U.S. had the worst results of all the developed countries, but was spending about the same amount of money to get there. And now roll forward to 2005, and the U.S. still gets the worst results. Actually, we've dropped a little further back in terms of results, but we spend twice as much money to get those results. So clearly, our healthcare delivery system, both in terms of cost and outcomes, is going in the wrong direction. And lest you think that only applies to general healthcare, not oral health, this is the predicted spending from CMS in terms of our total national oral health expenditures, which is going up, slowed down a little bit during the recession. This is not inflation adjusted, so it actually went down a little bit in the last couple of years, but still predicted to be a large increase, 271% by the time we get to 2020 compared to 2000. So we're spending a lot more money, and one might think that, well, that's great, we're spending more money because more people are getting dental care, but of course I think those in this room know that's actually not the case. And in fact, this analysis of dentist income that was just published in the ADA Journal just a couple months ago shows that the black line, which is at the top there, is actually the average visits per capita, shows that people are visiting dentists less. And that trend started in the year 2003. So the average visits per capita to dental office has been dropping since 2003. Also, what clearly indicates that it's not that people are spending more money on dental care, but dental care is becoming more affordable, is this comparison of the consumer price index, the green line, which is generally considered the rate of inflation, compared to the separately tracked consumer price index for dental services. And it's pretty easy to see that the cost of dental care for the average person getting the average amount of dental care is going up about twice the rate of inflation. So dental care is becoming more expensive for the average person, and more expensive in a time when we pay for dental care much more out of pocket than other services. So I don't think I can actually point to things on this. No, I don't seem to be able to. But the purple bar on the lower right is the expenditures for dental care, which is second only to prescription drugs in terms of what people pay for out of pocket. So clearly, dental care is much more price sensitive than general health services, where it's typically covered by some kind of a benefit program. People aren't as concerned about the price of an individual procedure, much more so in dental care, where they're paying for it, much more likely to be paying out of pocket. And you can see that in the contribution to our total dental expenses. Is that a pointer or something? Yeah, it's okay. I'll do it this way. You can see that the contribution to our total dental expenses The bar at the graph is actually the most, the green line at the bottom is the most interesting one, which is the contribution to our total national dental expenses by public payers. And what you can see there is that from the year 2000 to the year 2020, it's predicted to go from 4% to 13% of the total national dental bill, which means that public payers are tripling their investment in the total dental care expenditures for the country. And when public payers start to triple their investment, that gets their attention, and they start to think about what are we getting for all the money that we're spending. So I think this is going to be a major driver of change as we move into the future. All that's happening, dental care getting more expensive at a time when people have actually less disposable income. So this is real disposable income for across various strata of the income distribution in our country. And you can see that it's actually dropped for every era or every part of the income distribution, less so at the top and more so at the bottom. But real disposable income is going down at a time when dental care is getting more expensive. So, and you know that this is a little bit old, this chart, but some of you recognize it, that some of our indicators of success are actually going in the wrong direction, that percentage of children with untreated caries and other measures are actually doing the same thing in medicine, where we're spending more money and getting less results. So that's the increasing cost decreasing results from all that money we're spending. The other major driver is the harm and variability results. And in the general healthcare system, this was clearly pointed out by the Institute of Medicine several reports back in the 1990s, which really drew national attention to it, to Errors Human and Crossing the Quality Chasm. This is the Dartmouth Atlas. So those of you who are not aware of it, it's a system that's been going on. People at Dartmouth have been tracking health expenditures for many decades, and they're using Medicare expenses as a proxy. And you can see the difference in the colors in the areas of the country had to do with the amount of money that it costs to have health care, general health care, depending on where you live. And this is all adjusted for the age of the population and other kinds of variables that you might think might contribute to it costing more in some places than others, but actually, in fact, it doesn't. And you can see maybe on a little chart on the right, that the amount of money that's being spent per capita on average ranges from about $5,000 up to $16,000. So a triple of the cost in some areas of the country compared to others. And some of you are familiar with this article by Atul Gawande back in 2009 called The Cost Conundrum, where he tried to figure out why is it so much more expensive to get health care in one part of the country versus another. So he went to the most expensive place, he says, in the country to get health care, which is a city called McAllen, Texas. Anybody from McAllen, Texas? Nobody. So the most expensive place to get health care is a city called McAllen, Texas. And he, just one little snippet from the article, he said, if you go into the Mayo Clinic and you have indigestion and some kind of funny feelings in your abdomen, and you tell the story to your physician, and the physician decides that these are signs of gallbladder disease, that you're going to get some diet counseling, and maybe after that doesn't work, you might get some medication, and that might go on for 3 or 4 months before some decision is made to do anything else. If you walk into a physician's office in McAllen, Texas, with exactly the same set of symptoms, you'll have your gallbladder out within a week. And he characterizes that as a cultural difference in the way that the physicians in McAllen, Texas think about their business. They have much more of his description, much more of an orientation that their job is to wring as much money out of that business as they can. And so I think that we all understand that that's also the case in dentistry, that there's a huge variability in terms of what people get, recommendations people have for dental care. I certainly have done second opinions on consultations for people that I thought needed a few simple things, and they're bringing me a quote from another dentist who wanted to do a $50,000 reconstruction, which I thought was really unwarranted and actually could be harmful to the patient. So we have that kind of variability in terms of results and outcomes in dentistry as well. And all of that, of course, leads to health disparities. And this was pretty clearly demonstrated in this 2003 IOM report called Unequal Treatment, where they said that clearly demonstrated that racial and ethnic minorities tend to receive a lower quality of health care than non-minorities, even when access-related factors such as insurance and status and income are controlled. And, of course, we know that we have the same thing in oral health care, going back to the Surgeon General's report, and these things now a decade later certainly have not changed, that we have profound disparities among racial and ethnic minorities and people with disabilities and elderly individuals and people with complicated medical and social conditions. So these factors which are driving healthcare reform in our country all apply to the oral healthcare system. And it's pretty clear that there's a lot of activity going on in general healthcare to try and do something about this. You see paper performance systems where there's been demonstrations going on for a decade now, accountable care, bundled payments, lots of different things to try to address this runaway cost and poor results that we're getting. Sort of summarize in the triple aim, Don Berwick called for improving the experience of care and improving the health of populations and doing all that at the same time we're reducing the per capita costs of healthcare. So better experiences, better care, and lower costs. And all of these, again, apply to what we need to do in oral health care as well. The thing I want to just underscore in all the things that are happening in medicine that I think has the most relevance for us to think about in terms of the head in the clouds and feet on the ground strategy is this idea of moving payment from volume to value. So this was a 2010 article from the Urban Institute that talked about moving payment from volume to value and also gets into the role of performance measurement. But for those of you not familiar with that term, what this is referring to is that we, in large part in our general healthcare system and almost entirely in our oral healthcare system, pay for things based on volume. So the more you do, the more money you get. If you're in a fee-for-service system, you're paid for procedures. You get the more procedures you do, the more money you get. If you're in an FQHC and are paid based on encounters, the more encounters you have, the more money you get. And if you're in a capitated system, the more enrollees you have, the more money you get. None of those things are actually directly tied to the health outcomes of the population that are being served. So this idea of moving from that kind of volume-based system to value, Michael Porter, who's at Harvard, has done a lot of work and written this book called Redefining Healthcare and a number of articles. This is just a couple bullet points from his article in the New England Journal of Medicine talking about what does it mean by value-based care. He talks about value is defined as health outcomes achieved per dollar spent over the life cycle of a condition. So what does that mean over the life cycle of a condition? Well, his example is things like diabetes. So if you have diabetes and you have a visit to a physician's office, it really is not all that important what happens in that particular visit to that physician's office. What's important is can you control the diabetes over some period of time, and that might be a period of years that you want to see. Does the diabetes remain under control? Do you have fewer diabetic complications, other kinds of things? So that's the life cycle, long life cycle of condition compared to that episodic visit to a physician's office. And I'd say the same thing applies in oral health care as we start to think about value-based care. You certainly would not think that the measure of that is a particular episode of care in a dentist's office. Dentist person has a hole in their tooth, they've got dental caries, the dentist does a filling. That's an episode of care, but what we really want to be looking at is the caries process and what happens over a number of years. And the person have recurrent disease, or they lose teeth, that would be looking at caries over the life cycle of a condition. So you'd want to have a value-based system based on the outcomes achieved over the life cycle of that condition. And he says that process measures and improvement are important tactics, but are no substitutes for measuring outcomes and costs. So why do I think that this is going to impact us in the oral healthcare delivery system? Well, I think that it's in the future. There are many organizations and groups now that are actively working on moving us in this direction. This is a list of just some of them, and I'll just come back and touch on some of these in the next few minutes. I think you all know that in terms of measurements, oral healthcare has now been deemed a leading health indicator, having one oral health measure and among the 20 Healthy People 2020 leading health indicators. This one actually was to me underscores the fact that people at the highest levels of government are starting to pay attention to oral health care and oral health care outcomes. This was a study that was commissioned from the National Quality Forum by the Department of Health and the Federal Department of Health and Human Services. So the National Quality Forum, if you're not familiar with them, is sort of considered the gold standard agency for vetting health measurements. So people want to have a health measure nationally considered. They would submit it to the National Quality Forum. They go through a rigorous process. And so they had a study commissioned by the Department of HHS to look at oral health performance measures and what ought to happen with them in the future. So I had the pleasure of serving as co-chair of that committee. The report is downloadable from the NQF website and talks about the fact that we have many, many measures out there. The staff did an environmental scan and found something like 225 measures that were in use somewhere, but the problem was they were mostly ill-defined. It wasn't clear what they could be used for, and there was almost no examples of oral health performance measures that were being used to actually use as incentives to drive people to do anything differently than they were currently doing. That was the bottom line for it. So a lot of work yet to do in terms of developing and using measures. Same thing going on in the CHIPRA Pediatric Quality Measures Program. When they reauthorized the CHIPRA, or the Children's Health Insurance Program, there was a mandatory part of that just looking at pulling together an expert panel, which I also serve on, and looking at how measures can be used to drive change in children's health care, including oral health care. Some other examples of people that are actively engaged in this work to try and figure out how do we begin to move oral health care into the era of accountability using measurements. Large group practices are actively engaged in this. Health Partners now has developed, they have many guidelines and measures that they collect data on, but they actually pay their providers based on their performance on some measures now. So tobacco cessation is one. They do education, and those providers that actually do better in terms of getting their patients to stop using tobacco or to reduce their tobacco usage actually get a bonus in their paycheck. So it's actually now a beginning of a system to actually tie performance measures to real incentives that are paid, that are tied to money. The American Dental Association has convened this Dental Quality Alliance, which is a multi-stakeholder group to look at developing quality measures. They're still in the developing measures stage, but at some point, one would hope that those measures would get applied to performance in a way that would drive people to do something different. The dental benefits industry has also begun to look at this. You know, dental benefits industry has access to claims data, which is a rich source of data. It's one sort of narrow window on what actually happens in the real world, but it is a window. And there are a number of dental benefits companies, including Delta Dental in the East, in Massachusetts, and some other states that are beginning to do provider profiling. So I saw some work that they're doing now where they're actually looking at the use of sealants. One example was the use of sealants among dentists who are treating caries-active children. And caries-active children, they can detect that, even though we don't have diagnostic codes in dentistry. But if a dentist is doing lots of restorations on children, you would presume that their population of children are caries-active, either that or they're doing unnecessary treatment. But we'll be generous and say that they're doing have a population of children who are caries-active. And so dentist is doing lots of restorations and not doing very many sealants. That would be an indication that maybe they're not following evidence-based guidelines on the use of sealants. And they actually saw a graph where they looked at 1,000 different dental practices, had a graph of the percentage of children who, these are all some threshold for caries-active children, lots of restorations, percentage of sealants that were placed in these practices. And it went from the graph, which is 0-1%. Most of the way along the graph was 1-2% of kids got sealants. And in the last, about 3-4% of the practices got up to 50% of children. So what they're doing now is they're feeding back this information to the dental practices saying, do you realize that there are guidelines? Here's a copy of the guidelines about using sealants, and you might want to think about that because it looks like your population is caries active, and maybe you want to think about placing more sealants. So right now they're starting to do this profiling and using it in an educational mode, but you can imagine that in the future going to a system where they might actually tie performance measures to ability of people to follow evidence-based guidelines. The other thing going on is the DentalQuest National Oral Health Quality Initiative. The DentalQuest Institute is facilitating a national group of people that are looking at developing a 10-year roadmap to figure out how to use the tools of quality and accountability to drive change in our healthcare delivery system. Another sign of this movement, I think, is one that I just added to the presentation about a half hour ago, because I just got some data from Bob Eisman, thank you, Bob, is that in the California Medicaid program, there's a portion of it, it's not a large portion, a portion of it is managed care, although that's expected to grow across the country. And there was just a new procurement for health contracts and health plans. And in that procurement contract, there's actually performance measures that are written in. And there is the ability to, there's actually financial incentives for the health plan to do better on these performance measures. So they have the possibility of, you can see their proportion of 10% withhold paid to contractors, so they can actually have money taken away if they don't do a good job on the performance measures. Or they can have a bonus payment based on their performance on these performance measures. So if I do the math right, it looks like they can lose 10% and they can gain 5%. So maybe there's a possibility of 15% swing in terms of their performance on these performance measures, which, you know, I think people understand that if you have performance measures, the bonus is too low. Health plans and providers sometimes consider it a discount and don't want to bother with it. If it's more trouble, it's easier just not to do it and just take it as a discount. But I think perhaps we'll see if a 15% potential swing is enough to incentivize people to really try to go after meeting these performance measures. But I think it's an example, though, of what I'm saying, which is that we're going to increasingly see payers and others tying performance measures to incentives that actually drive people to do something different than they've done in the past. So this is a chart from that report on the era of quality and accountability that I think sort of summarizes where I think we're going in our country. The left side, the left arrow, the green one, is the rise of electronic health records. And so we're in an era now where electronic health records are becoming more ubiquitous. We're in a position now where we can do a lot better job than we have in the past of collecting and aggregating data that leads us to the ability to measure and monitor care and outcomes of care. And now that we're in that era, we can begin to do some of the things you're hearing about, which is to provide incentives based on health outcomes. You know, that there's the national incentives for collecting and managing data and meaningful use bonuses that are available now. All that's going to drive us to a system where we can begin to apply incentives based on health outcomes. And as we do that, we can begin to move from the era of volume to the era of value, and I call that the era of accountability. So I think we're already begun that journey, moving from strictly volume-based system to an accountable system that's going to start to look at value in the healthcare delivery system. And as we move further into that era of having value be the thing that we judge our healthcare system by and reward people, then all of the things that you see in those purple areas on the right are going to become much more important. I think that's going to drive profound change in the delivery system, because if we're actually paid based on the value of what we're delivering, then it's pretty inevitable we're going to start to look at delivering care in non-traditional settings. If we're paid for the health of populations who don't traditionally go to a dental office, then clearly we're going to have to do something to reach those populations, to get care out into the community and to reach those populations. All the work that's being done now about new types of allied personnel and expanding roles for different for existing allied personnel all become much more important as you start to think about reaching people who are not being reached now, getting non-dental providers involved, developing true health homes, developing systems for using telehealth and prevention and early intervention, and then thinking about chronic disease management. So this is my prediction that this is the direction we're going. As we move further into the era of accountability, it's going to drive significant healthcare delivery system change. One example of that is a project we're doing in California, which this is sort of a shameless plug to ask you to come to the 12:30 presentation today, where we're going to be talking more about that. But it's a system for reaching out into the community using telehealth-enabled delivery systems to connect providers together. So I think that we have actually a huge opportunity in our country, and both a huge opportunity to do better and to reach more people, and a huge opportunity to try to educate our profession that there actually is an opportunity. Many people in our profession now perceive the changes in our delivery system and the things that people are talking about as threats. And I think we have an opportunity to try and help them understand that there are huge actually opportunities out there. Just one of them, looking at the number of underserved people in our country, you know, back to that article that just came out a few weeks ago, or a few months ago in the ADA Journal, which, as I showed you this earlier, actually the title of the article is an analysis of dentist income and showing that net income for dentists has been going down over the last number of years. What I found actually more interesting in that article was this one table that showed the average number of populations that had visited a general practitioner within a year. And you can see back from 1996 up to 2009, it was hovering right about 40%. So if there's only 40% of the people that are visiting a dental office once a year, that means 60% aren't. And there's, again, a huge opportunity to do something to reach those other people. I think no matter how you look at the number of unreached people, it turns out to be large. If you look at the U.S. population of 307 million people, that data about people who don't visit a dentist once a year, that would be 180 million people potentially could be brought into the system in some way. If you look at the ADA's calculation of 30% of the population, that would still be 90 million people. If you look at people below the poverty level, it's 44 million people, or 125% of the poverty level, 57 million people. All those numbers are huge compared to what we're actually delivering in the safety net, which is about 10 million people actually having care in the safety net. So clearly there's a lot of opportunity to reach people who are not being reached now if we can think differently about the way we organize, deliver, and pay for systems. So I think the opportunities are some of these, the opportunities to develop partnerships to be able to do this kind of work. I think in the modern world that we're living in now, you can't do things alone as an individual or even as an organization or even as a single profession. So partnerships are going to be the thing that are going to drive us forward, including interprofessional collaborations, use of new technology, new health teams, and fully integrated health homes. I think as we're thinking about our head in the clouds and our feet on the ground, some of the feet on the ground stuff that we can begin to work on now to move us in that direction are things like continuing the push towards meaningful use of data in quality improvement systems. We're kind of at the beginning of that now, and I think we've got a lot of opportunity to do work and to understand how to better collect data and use it in meaningful ways. We're also at the beginning of figuring out how to do community-based practice and actually get paid for it. And I'm talking about community-based practice. I'm not talking about a dental office located in a community. I'm talking about delivering care in a school or in a Head Start center or in a nursing home, that kind of community-based practice. Learn how to do that. Learn how to connect people doing those things through telehealth and make geographically distributed collaborative teams, interprofessional collaborative teams. Learning how to think about the regulatory systems that right now inhibit us from doing the things that I'm talking about. So how can those regulatory systems be altered to be able to allow that kind of new delivery system to foster and grow? And think about what kind of benefit systems, if you were, I'm actually talking to people in the dental benefits industry who are now saying, okay, I sort of see where things are going, but what should we do? We have, this is how we traditionally do our business. It's hard for them to get a concept of what their business might look like in a new world. So there's a lot of work that we can do to try and work with dental benefits and help them think about what would that benefit business look like in a world where you're truly delivering accountability and value-based care. Of course, we need to develop and educate providers for a future world that might look very different. And we were just talking about the, what did you say, Scott? Like changing the dental curriculum is like moving a graveyard. So, I was at a group of dental benefits, mostly dental benefits people, about 3 or 4 weeks ago, and I asked them how many were dentists. And most people in the room, it was maybe 300 people or 400 people in the room, how many were dentists? And I asked them how many of them remember the class that they had in dental school where they were taught to use telehealth-enabled collaborative distributed teams. And, of course, nobody remembers that class because that class doesn't exist in any dental school. But if we're actually going to move into a world like that, we need to think about how do we educate people for that world. And then, of course, how do we think about this whole era of accountability and developing systems that are based on outcomes of the eligible populations. So, again, I think this is our sort of chart where I think we're going. And I think we have tremendous opportunities if we can remember to think about that as we get caught up in our day-to-day activities. Remember to think about this bigger world that we're moving into and try to focus our day-to-day activities so we get prepared for that and help move in that direction. So thank you.
Thank you.